From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, we're talking Hamilton this hour. There we go. We're talking Hamilton this hour. The award-winning musical just completed a sold-out run in Rochester, and we're asking whether Hamilton is historically accurate. We're also wondering, do you care if it's accurate? The story, of course, is Alexander Hamilton, his life as an immigrant, everything that he went through early on in his life, and it includes all kinds of different elements with the kind of casting that is much more representative than we often see on stages on Broadway and elsewhere. And it's obviously very, very popular. You can't get tickets unless you know somebody or you want to pay a lot of money. And it's all around the country, Chicago, San Francisco, now Cleveland, Rochester, of course, Broadway. Well, this hour, we're talking Hamilton, but also movies like Lincoln, the concept of historical fiction, biopics, books, just how much we should expect when it comes to accuracy. After all, many of the people who see shows like Hamilton are not going to read biographies. They're not going to delve into historical texts. They might not remember very much that they learned from, I don't know, professors like Michael Oberg. So we're going to talk this hour about what we ought to expect and how much accuracy matters. Michael Oberg is a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo. It's always nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Linda Sue Park, an award-winning author with us here in studio. Nice to have you, Linda Sue.
Thank you.
And Miriam Burstein is a professor and associate chair in the Department of English at the College at Brockport. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Michael, you're the one in this room who's seen Hamilton, by the way. I mean, we all know Hamilton. We've had the music. I have still never seen it. You have.
From quite a distance.
We were up high on the balcony.
It's a fantastic musical. It's entertaining. The music's great. The set design. I mean, everything that I like about going to see the theater is wonderful in the play. I love it. As a historian, it's another matter entirely. And look, I do history for my day job, so I don't care too much about history in my entertainment. I can separate the two. But what troubled me most about the popularity of the play is it's based, I think it's well known that Lin-Manuel Miranda based the story on Ron Chernow's very, very popular biography of Alexander Hamilton, which is what we in the business nowadays call founder's chic, right? It's this truckload after truckload of biographies of the founding fathers. They're popular, they're interesting stories, but that's only a very, very limited part of the story of the American Revolution. And to me, and certainly to the 25 years worth of students I've taught, it's not the most interesting part of the Revolution.
Well, I want to read a little bit of what Lin-Manuel Miranda said about trying to be historically accurate, because there are going to be listeners, and that's fine, listeners who say, come on, this is obviously it's historical fiction. It's necessarily fiction. You can't, digest every little bit of it. Well, here's what Miranda had to say. He said that it is by necessity a work of fiction, but accuracy matters. And the Smithsonian, among other sources, said, though Miranda has said in interviews that he felt, quote, an enormous responsibility to be as historically accurate as possible, his artistic representation of Hamilton will remain fiction with moments of imprecision and dramatization. In 2017, Miranda won a Freedom Award, and the U.S. Capitol Historical Society said they wanted to give him this award because of his unique ability to engage new audiences with our history and his dedication to inspiring informed civic participation. That's what the Historical Society's chair, Don Carlson, said in a statement. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, look, there's a lot of history in the play. They cover in close compass Hamilton's financial program, which interests dozens of people in the 1790s. They deal with the duel. They deal briefly with his role at the Constitutional Convention. Historians don't just excavate facts and build up a story brick by brick. We select facts. And Lin-Manuel Miranda selected elements of that story to fictionalize. And to my mind, he didn't select some of the most troubling and disturbing things about Hamilton. To my mind, Hamilton never really thought of himself as an immigrant. He was moving from one part of the empire to another, like thousands and thousands of people did during the colonial period. He says he sees Hamilton as sort of a champion of popular democracy. He mentions Hamilton's six-hour speech at the opening of the Philadelphia Convention, which essentially called for a return to monarchy, a president for life. He says nothing about Hamilton's utter disdain for popular rule, for the capacity of ordinary people to govern their affairs and responsible people, and some of the shady things he did, right? The financial thing shows up in the play, but his involvement around the edges of this event known as the Newburg Affair, where a number of historians suggested there was a coup contemplated among revolutionary officers at the end of the Revolutionary War, to essentially replace the government. You know, so there's a lot of things left out of the story so it's not so much that he made stuff up that bothers me, it's the stories he didn't select.
Okay. Well, Linda Sue Park, you are someone who I want to hear your perspective as an author who has to consider elements of accuracy in the work that you create, but also, given that, if you were going to Hamilton, how much are you thinking in your own mind, I wonder, or it matters to me, that they're getting this right?
Well, I think I have to back all the way up to the word accuracy, because I guess it's well known that if you have five people witness the same event, the same facts, they're going to interpret them differently. We all have our own individual and different lens. And the problem with the historical record is that the lens has been wielded largely by one dominant group. And that's the record that we have left. So it's very interesting to hear Michael talk about what was left out of Hamilton's story, because as an author, I can't put everything in. You know, I don't have 1,200 pages, especially for my audience. And yet I can hear what he's saying about wanting to create the wholeness of the person that you're depicting. When I do my research into historical record, again, keeping in mind that what we're working with is largely dominant culture. The three questions in looking at primary sources or sources from the time are: who wrote it? Why did they write it? Why has it survived? And the answers to those three questions are almost always rooted in some kind of privilege. So while I see what Michael's saying about Hamilton and the difference between moving around the empire and being an immigrant, there are thousands of young people, which is my main concern, there are thousands of young people right now who think that Alexander Hamilton, or who know that Alexander Hamilton was an immigrant. And if that's the only fact that they take away from the musical, I see that as a good thing.
Okay, interesting. Interesting perspective. Miriam, how do you view the importance of, or not, of how much they're getting, quote-unquote, right?
So when I, as someone who specializes in historical fiction, from a scholarly point of view, the question of what does it mean to get stuff right, and is there something moral, right? Are there moral questions involved in getting something right or not? These go all the way back in Europe, go all the way back to Sir Walter Scott in the 19th century. There's an entire cottage industry in the 19th century of historians complaining about Walter Scott and Walter Scott getting things wrong. And what does that mean for our understanding of Scottish history or English history or European history? And we have never answered these questions. We've asked the same question. Literally, the same questions have been asked about historical fiction and its accuracy or not for the past couple of centuries. So I'm not sure that it's going to be an answerable question in that respect. When I watch something like, say, a British monarchy film, British monarchy films never have anything right about the history. In fact, it's usually amazing how much they manage to get wrong. When I was in graduate school and watching the Judi Dench vehicle, Her Majesty Mrs. Brown, about Queen Victoria, I remember sitting there in the theater totally appalled because nothing about that film is historically accurate at all. And yet when I left the theater, I said, all right, but what is the argument that the inaccuracies are helping them make about the subject, because they do have a larger historical argument about the past that is emerging from the various distortions that they inserted, some of which, like the prime minister that goes entirely missing from the film, are necessary for dramatic effect, but others have to do with their understanding of what this past was. And so I always move to that point.
Yeah, and so I want to kind of return to Linda Sue's idea about, at the very least, is there a net good here? If the audience takes a certain element to the story and now understands it better, setting aside all the different details, the inner working relationships, et cetera. And I want to ask Professor Oberg, if you generally see this as a net good or a net negative. And I want to sort of give away something really embarrassing about myself. I still have in a blue folder probably 40 pages of a book that I started to write in seventh grade on a typewriter. And it was about Lewis and Clark, and it was the stupidest story idea anybody's ever created. The idea was Meriwether Lewis dies in a duel before setting out on this, but the government can't tell people because this has been billed as a very important expedition, so they find a dead ringer for Lewis to go out on this. And the historian who finds, I think, a diary of Jefferson while he's burying his dead hamster Napoleon in the backyard, it's the dumbest story idea ever, but I was in seventh grade. And even in seventh grade, I remember thinking, boy, I'm going to have to do a lot of reading about what these people were actually like. This seems like too much work, and I gave up after 40 pages. Well, you've got Chernow's biography, which you have called Founder Chic, but Manuel Miranda says that he really tried to work from it and did so for years. And then the question becomes, what are you left with? Well, Linda Sue is left with this idea that at least if people are thinking about the story of an immigrant. What about you, Professor? Is there a net good or a net negative or a concern that you have? If people are left with X, it's a bad thing. If people are left with Y, at least that's better.
Oh, I think anything that gets people interested in history is a positive. even if they're watching Game of Thrones and they get interested in medieval warfare, which the show gets completely crazily wrong, right? I think that interesting. We have a dearth of historical literacy in this country. It would be great to get more people interested in history. I'm all for that. My objection to it was I think there's other stories that are more interesting. The founding fathers are important. Of course they are, right? But they wrote their proclamations, and the way the play conveys it, the revolution is something that it's carried out in the boardrooms, in the offices, in the officers' quarters. Revolution also happened in the street. It happened amongst the rank and file who were fighting, and without ordinary people involving themselves in the revolution, these proclamations would just be forgotten manifestos that we'd never read. And I'll give you the specific example I give in my classes, right? At Concord, April 19th, 1775, the first battle of the revolution, the Minutemen, who are just ordinary guys in Concord, right? Watching the British coming into their town, looking for the weapons that they'd hidden there, right? And they see that there's a threat to their town. They march down to the bridge. The British march out to meet them. They stand, 120 feet apart, 40 yards, right? The distance from home plate to second base, right? And they open fire, and the British run, and they proceed to essentially hunt these guys down and ambush them the rest of the way back out of town. To me, that question of how do these ordinary people get to that point where they're willing to stand that close to the finest soldiers on the face of the earth and exchange gunfire? If you can explain that, you can learn a lot more about the revolution than you can looking at the writings of the founders.
All right. Well, let's listen to a little bit of the music from Hamilton, because in the music, it tries to convey a lot of information right out of the gate about Alexander Hamilton. And some of our listeners are already responding, saying, here's Kara, who says, I don't know if the main point of the show is to provide facts set to music. I think the humanity of the founding fathers gets lost over time. And what I think Hamilton excels at is breathing life into the one-dimensional portraits that we have in our history books. Let's listen to a little bit of one of the opening numbers in Hamilton.
How does an orphan render Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came. And the world's gonna know your name. What's your name?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait.
there you are with some of the details of in that just that opening number, and I'm writing down notes here from the lyrics. Longing for something to be a part of, working harder, working smarter, a man without a father. These are the kinds of elements that would probably humanize anyone. Let's hope that they're true. But Linda Sue Park, do you agree with Kara, who says, at the very least, we kind of think about the Founding Fathers as really distant, one-dimensional, not really alive with history, and what you feel in that music is these were real people with dreams who took risks, and that there's value in that.
Yes, I think I do agree with Kara. I guess my main concern is always if you take the photograph or whatever of the main event that's happening, the people who are on the edges, sort of what Michael was talking about. For all their dimensionality or lack of it, every school child in this country, most of them anyway, know about the Founding Fathers, right? We have that history. That's a part of us. What we don't get is the stories of the people around the edges. And we need that multiplicity of stories. We need, just like, you know, in a court case, you need viewpoints from as many witnesses as you can get. What we get is a very one-dimensional education in history here in this country, especially in the schools. And that's what I find, exciting about Hamilton is, first of all, that it is humanizing the Founding Fathers and looking at aspects that maybe are not taught in schools. Certainly, I didn't get any of this very much of it about Alexander Hamilton in schools, right? And I also have to say that Hamilton gets nowhere without Lin-Manuel Miranda's skill as an artist. Okay, I mean, those lyrics, mm-hmm. I mean, they're really something, right? I mean, and you can tell it was however many years of work. So however you feel about it as a historical document or whatever you want to call it, I think that his skill as a writer, as a poet, as a performer, has to be factored into that. You know, somebody else does Hamilton, it doesn't explode like it has in our popular imagination.
Okay. Miriam, how do you feel about that?
One of the things that's interesting me is the shift in our understanding of what it means to humanize them, because I'm thinking of this one of this musical's big antecedents, which is, of course, another musical, 1776, from the late 1960s, which actually gets quoted in Hamilton. Sit down, John, right, is from the opening number of...
For God's sake, John,
sit down. Right, exactly. And that, which was another musical, which was an attempt to imagine how can you be patriotic in the 1960s, right, during the Vietnam War era. That musical humanized the Founding Fathers. How did they do it? By making them funny, right? I mean, it's a musical comedy in the way that Hamilton really is not a musical comedy. That approach to humanizing the Founding Fathers, even though 1776 still goes over really well, I notice that when we think about Hamilton, when we think about humanizing them, we are in fact thinking about their private lives. We're thinking about their, in Hamilton's case, the way he completely screws up his private life, right, in many ways, and that the to think about Hamilton's entire biography, as Linda Sue has just said, right? Hamilton as an immigrant, whether or not that's accurate, as Michael has pointed out, is a very different approach to thinking about what it means to make these people human.
So, Michael, when you say you're really interested in how we had so many people, rank and file America, young colonists, right, willing to stand across a field from somebody, hold a gun knowing that that's the best army in the world and they're going to try to kill me, and they're willing to do it. That story is more interesting to you than whether the guy had marital struggles who founded the banking system.
But I would rather hear about the ordinary men who served in the militias. I would like to hear about the African Americans whom Hamilton talked about organizing into a regiment during the Revolutionary War with some considerable opposition.
So set that aside, though. Is there something valuable in reminding people that these were still human beings?
Of course there is. I absolutely agree with what Kara is saying about, you know, fleshing out these characters. Yeah. We've been doing that for generations when his wife started compiling the papers and casting the story. That's been done for a long time for the Founding Fathers. You see these in these biographies. Some of them do it beautifully. Some of them don't do it so well, but that's what biographers try to do. there's a lot of other people who I want to see humanized, who I find far more compelling, who had much, you know, an enormous amount at stake during the Revolution. Founding Fathers did too, but there's some incredible stories of the Revolution.
Why isn't there a musical called Crispus Attucks?
Yeah. Why not? I mean, I think that's a great question. I would love to have a musical number where the women in Boston during the Revolution kick open the door of the bakery, throw the just price for the bread down on the counter, and take everything in it. Because the vendor is jacking up his prices during a shortage. I would love to see that. I would, you know, I think there's some fantastic stories. Yeah.
All right. So now let's read a little of the criticism. Author William Hoagland criticized Chernow and Lin-Manuel Miranda and their depiction of Hamilton as, quote, a manumission abolitionist, as someone who favored the immediate voluntary emancipation of all slaves. Though Hamilton did hold moderately progressive views towards slavery, Hoagland says, it's likely that he and his family did own household slaves, cognitive dissonance typical of the time that Chernow and Miranda have downplayed. And he laments that the biography and the show give the, quote, false impression that Hamilton was special among the Founding Fathers, in part because he was a staunch abolitionist, continuing that satisfaction and accessibility pose serious risks to historical realism. Fair criticism there, Michael?
I think so. I think it's very fair. I mean, Hamilton, like a lot of the founding generation, found slavery morally troubling. He did try to organize African Americans. But I think one of the things we realize is that one way to unify the colonies was to not talk about slavery. And as you can see, just going on today, right, discussions of Confederate monuments and things like that, this country has an enormous amount of difficulty still talking about slavery. Hamilton wasn't an abolitionist. Some of the founders did write positive things where legislative changes went into effect to eradicate slavery in some of the northern colonies. He did have moderately progressive views by the time. Nothing came of the Revolution. You could argue that many places, particularly in the South, slavery was much stronger after the Revolution than before. These are things that shouldn't be dismissed, right? We can say, well, it's the product of the time. No, you can't say that these are farsighted, brilliant, incredible human beings and say, oh, but they were limited in this one area. I don't give the founders that pass.
In this one area that happens to be the biggest moral stain.
Yeah.
And so Linda Sue, when you think about the way this show or any biography of Hamilton or any sort of depiction, I say biography, that's the difference between Chernow's work and Miranda's work. I mean, Miranda's work is a work of fiction. Chernow seeks to be a biography. But when you've got a show like Hamilton and you've got these really sort of this interesting juxtaposition of the critics immediately gravitating toward the representation on stage, people of color in these roles, you know, sort of a hip hop and a rap flavor to American history at the time of the Revolution. It's different. It's interesting. But what you've got Hoagland and others saying is that seems to have absolved the idea of making sure we're still clear on who sought to own slaves and who did and didn't do the work to change that. Does that trouble you?
I was struck by when you read the quote, the language in it itself saying, it is very likely that Hamilton's family owned domestic servants or whatever, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, that's right there. His criticism is based on it was very likely.
Supposition.
You know, right. Yeah. Supposition, not fact. Okay. So, which is, again, the difficulty in working with history in that there's, you know, how does he write a criticism like that unless you have the quote unquote fact to hand? Okay. That struck me about the language in there. And I think that we have to, again, go back to the fact that what solves the problem, if you can use those words, is having as many stories from as many people as possible, you know, and that's what me and colleagues in the children's literature field are working on all the time, you know, that we have there is such a richness of stories in the white American experience. You can be North, you can be South, you can be rich, poor, you can be, you know, and that provides a young reader with entry points into the study of American history or where my place in it is and so forth. Whereas with people from marginalized communities, the entry point is almost always trauma and struggle, right? As if that's our sole existence as a vis-a-vis the dominant culture. You know, we need many, many more stories of the kind Michael is talking about, and just everyday stories, and so that not just marginalized children, but children from marginalized communities can find their way into stories, but so that the dominant culture also understands that multiplicity of experience. Because a lot of them are going to grow up to be, whether it's CEOs or police, mm-hmm. you know, they need that multiplicity of stories. Without that, it's the source of like almost every social problem you can think of, you know? And the other thing that struck me is that when I'm researching historical fiction, one of the things that you're supposed to do is read historical fiction written during that era. So if I was writing about the 1960s, I would read books about the 1960s, but I would also read historical fiction written in the 1960s.
Why is that?
Because just like Hamilton is repositioning the lens to focus on immigrants and things that are our concerns today, that's what historical fiction writers always do. They refocus the lens for the concerns of that moment. So in order to figure out what the concerns of the 1960s or the 1830s or whatever would be, I would read historical fiction written at that time about whatever era.
Interesting.
Right? Because that's what those authors are doing. They're looking at the past through the concerns that occupy them at their time.
Interesting. Mary, you want to add to that?
I think what Linda Sue has just said is makes a really important point, and that's certainly one of the things that I think Miranda was trying to do in, unfortunately, obscuring what Hamilton's own actual attitudes to slavery were, which I agree is a massive flaw in terms of the text. But he really wanted to make Hamilton representative, a kind of marginalized figure. I mean, that was the lens he was trying to construct. And I imagine that's what's going through his head is, if I am trying to produce this this character who is my protagonist for the evening, how far does my audience go with me? If I also indicate that, by the way, he's actually not so far off from either Washington or Jefferson as I am trying to represent him. And to me, I suspect that he was probably underestimating what his audience could deal with in terms of Hamilton's complexity, right? But that he really did want to make him more representative of a kind of marginalized class than perhaps he actually would have been, right?
In our second half hour, we're going to have a lot of listener feedback. I've got a ton of comments here. But before we do that, I want to ask before we get to the break, one more question from me. I'm just turning it over to the audience after that. But one question for me, for all of our panelists, which is this. Take Hamilton, set it aside. Lincoln. Think about the most, the highest box office or the best-selling or the highest grossing forms of fiction, historical fiction in recent years. My view is that the accuracy does matter because for most Americans, there isn't a deep dive into history. I would like to think that even the small details are pretty faithful to history, because my suspicion is if you don't care about the small details, I probably can't trust you to care about the big details. But what really matters to me, at least as a consumer of these works of fiction, is if you've got the important themes correct. And I think for too long, we've had fan fiction about the founders, our history. We've had erasure. We've had, you know, and certainly Michael can talk for hours at length on the way we have written about and created history books about and fictional works about Native Americans and treatment. My concern is, I want to rely on you. It's not good enough for me to hear from Lin-Manuel Miranda or Spielberg with Lincoln or anything that, well, it's still just fiction. Because you are going to have people walking out of those theaters thinking that was how it went. And they are not following up. And so you better be right. That, to me, is where I kind of come down. Maybe not the littlest details, and I get you want to create narratives, etc. But it matters to me because many Americans aren't going to have another go of trying to make sense of it. And we've had a very white-centered history, and we've had a lot of problems with trying to get real about our history over the years. How do you feel about that, Linda?
Well, for me, what you say resonates a lot, because I write for young people who are going to be often having their first exposure to whatever I write about, right? So I do think that it's, again, a process of the selection. I have to select what's important to me, and then those important things I will try to be as accurate as I can, right? I can't cover everything. And so there will be, I think, for my work personally, more often sins of omission than actually sins of commission. And, you know, that's just, you know, what I hope, though. I don't ever want any of my books to provide answers. I want them to stimulate questions. So I hope if I make the story compelling enough that young readers will enter into it and exit from it with a spirit of inquiry. I want to know more about this so that it's not, again, just me, my voice, my book that's going to be the sole arbiter of whatever this historical event is in their minds.
Okay. Professor?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that the better historical movies, the critiques have often been, well, you left this out or you condensed these characters, and that has to be done to convey a complicated story in, what, 2 hours, 3 hours you have for a film. So that's not that big a deal to me. It's the committed errors that matter. And I think I agree with Linda Sue, right? We need to get more voices into these stories to tell new stories, right? There's no reason why we can't have a movie about ordinary soldiers, right? To go that and do that route and get that right. Between 1630 and 1780, two-thirds of the people who crossed the Atlantic to the English colonies were black. Mm-hmm. You look at the population at any one point in time, the colonies as a whole, it's twice as many white people, right? The West Indies, where Alexander Hamilton's from, was a huge mill, ground-up human beings. He was disadvantaged as, you know, coming of age in a world where illegitimacy was a burden without much help. But he was able to move. Millions of people in that same context weren't allowed to move. And when he went to the greatest city in the world, he would have walked down the streets past slaves in the greatest city of the world and a free black community in that greatest city in the world. All that would have been, I think, just wonderful things to flesh out in the story.
And weren't.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead, Miriam. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that in part it always comes back to what do we mean by was it accurate, right? I mean, because there is, as you say, are the details right? I mean, but can something be accurate in a larger sense in which, ironically, all the details may be wrong precisely because of the constraint of the genre of the historical film or the historical novel. In Hamilton, to get back to our sensible subject here, the moment where you have Jefferson, Madison, and Burr going to confront Hamilton about what turns out to be the Reynolds letters, right? None of those people were ever in the room together. None of them, and in fact, two of them weren't even involved in the Reynolds scandal. But you can't just suddenly bring in two more characters we have never seen before and will never see again to come and carry out this scene, right? But there's still a truth there. There is a bigger truth, and that Miranda has talked about exploring as to how, right, as to why Hamilton responded as arguably as stupidly as he proceeded to do to that entire scandal, right? And so, yeah, so as Linda Sue says, you know, it's often omission, but having to compress, right, that the fiction writer, in order to get something that an audience will accept, right, has to do things to the facts that a historian like Professor Oberg just cannot do. Right.
Well, Andy writes to us, say, Evan, I can enjoy movies like Gladiator or Braveheart despite historical inaccuracies because it's a story set during a time period. However, movies like Lincoln, which tell of actual events, I do expect to be accurate. And by the way, JFK is problematic. That's from Andy. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to your phone calls as we talk Hamilton and historical accuracy and what our expectations ought to be. That's next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, our WXXI colleague Brett Dahlberg joins us to talk about his months-long investigation into bike lanes in Rochester. What he found, whether it's safe, and what it means for all of us who would like to be on a bicycle. In our second hour, Rochester as a literature city and the impact of literature on social and political issues. Talk with you Friday. This is Connections. Professor Miriam Burstein is the Associate Chair of the Department of English at the College at Brockport. Professor Michael Oberg is a Distinguished Professor of History at SUNY Geneseo. Linda Sue Park is an award-winning author, and they have miles of qualifications beyond me. I'm just the guy who goes to see these shows to understand how accurate are they and how much should we care, whether it's Hamilton, which just concluded a sold-out run in Rochester, Lincoln, the film, and Boy, JFK, it's its own fascinating. Thank you, Andy, for that. But Tom in Brighton, we'll start with you on the phone, who thinks we're being a little, we're setting the bar too high. Why, Tom?
Yeah, excuse me. You know, if we go back to the earliest literature that we now take as history, or that indicates some history, works like the ones from Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, there's a lot of history there, and some of it has been verified archaeologically. But mostly we read that for the poetic and the literature value, as well as for the times that he lived in. If we set the standard that you're trying to set, Evan, we wouldn't be reading that as intently as we do and with as much interest. You can apply the same thing to the Bible. The Bible, most of us, not everyone, most of us don't take it literally, but there is certainly some history there. With the accuracy, we can argue back and forth. But we still read it very intently for many aspects, the morality, the ethics, things like that. And it's interesting. Never mind the accuracy. This stuff is sometimes just plain fun. And that's a big motivation for people to look into this.
Yeah. So thank you for the phone call. I think there's... that last point's an important one. And Edward emails and kind of piles onto this idea of fun and interest, which pushes back against my concern that most people aren't going to look for more information. Edward says, "My wife and I attended the Friday night performance on April 26th in Rochester, and we loved Hamilton. We then each spent a good part of the weekend searching out additional information about the historical figures in that musical. We also enjoy historical films and biopics. For us, shows and films such as Hamilton create questions that ignite our curiosity, inspire us to seek out more information." Well, that is exactly what our panelists want. The concern that someone like me has is that people don't really do that. And then they, and so, you know, Tom, I'll see what the panel says. But when you say, you know, how much can you really know? You know, are we setting the bar too high? If we're talking about the time that, quote unquote, the pilgrims broke bread with the Native Americans, if we get the details wrong on whether it rained that day, okay. But if we are telling kids that it was this harmonious thing, and that it was this holding hands and singing songs moment that just showed how nice everyone was to each other, which, by the way, that is the history that a lot of kids get in schools, then I've got a problem. If we get, it didn't really rain that day, or historical accounts vary, but that's what I've got the problem with. The bigger themes, if we're missing them, then I do care. What would you say to Tom?
Well, I think we'd refer back to Linda Sue's point about reading fiction from different points in time. There's been wonderful books just looking at narratives of Plymouth Plantation and the first Thanksgiving over the many years, and how people reconstruct that and cast that in their own terms. I disagree with Tom. I think we would read the Iliad, and we do read the Iliad, and we do read the Bible. We read them at my college as part of our general education curriculum. We read them intently. We don't, like Tom, we don't take them literally, but we do see them as this fantastic window into a world removed from us across time and space. And that's what history is all about, in my view, trying to understand people living in a different time and space from us. So, you know, I think, you know, it's okay to have a standard for accuracy. It's okay to have fun at the play. It's okay to want to have an audience leave with questions. Do with this play whatever you want, right? I mean, that's fine by me. You know, walk away with it, enjoy with it. I think it's fantastic that you're looking into more information. And I think if you do look for more information, you go beyond biographies and you look into this world, you'll realize how fascinating, how diverse, how complicated, how fragile the freedom was during the revolution that's celebrated in that play, how contingent everything was, and you get a much richer picture of it. The play is just a start, and Lincoln's just a start, and whatever other movie you want to talk about.
Miriam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Tom really touches on the question of just how, at a certain point, the author can't control what the audience is going to do, right, with that play. I mean, and certainly when I'm thinking of the Hamilton phenomenon, I mean, you get if you look online and you look around, I've looked at the websites that have been generated, and you see people, for example, at Genius, the people who have annotated the entire Hamilton score, right? I mean, that you get, on the one hand, people who have been motivated to do this very intensive research, and then you get people who have been motivated to do very different things with the Hamilton text, and that most historical novelists, what I think, say, well, we would like people to do a bit more research, that we'd like you to become curious. But sometimes that curiosity, right, that where that curiosity takes people is often incredibly unpredictable and sometimes goes in places where not only can the author not predict it, it might be the opposite of what the author wants them to do.
Linda Sue?
I guess my objection here is to the apparent opposition of fun or entertaining and accuracy. Mm-hmm. I'm not down with that. I see my job as writing historical fiction to make the accurate entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Important distinction.
Yeah.
You know, thank you, Tom. Yeah, go ahead.
Another thing is that, like, I'll defer to you too, right? The American Revolution doesn't really have its Dr. Zhivago or... Mm-hmm. It doesn't have its great novel of the revolution, in my view.
Johnny Tremaine?
Right. Well, that's, you know.
And exactly.
And how old is that? Right. I mean, it's like, you know, so, I don't think this play is it. I think there's a greater work to be done out there. But part of it is we don't have that novel.
Hmm. Interesting. Philip in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Philip.
Hello. I've been enjoying the program, but I take some issue with one of your commentators who referred to 1776 being a funny humanization of the Founding Fathers, because it's actually a fairly dark play. The humor is mostly in the first act.
True.
The end of the act actually concludes with an unnamed courier mm-hmm. speaking about a friend of his who's just died in the field. And the second act is entirely concerned with two issues which are quite, you know, relevant today. One is clause condemning slavery, which was objected to by Edward Rutledge. So, you know, civil rights was a big part of the show in the 1960s.
Sure, I think we're just riffing on the fact that a lot of people remember just somebody open up a window, you know, and
well,
you know, that was funny. You're right, but
my other point, is that not only is history badly taught, it's badly remembered in the United States. The whole second act is about you know, the problems of militarization and also civil rights. Mm-hmm. Which makes it a much more textured work in that respect. And it's a terribly inaccurate musical.
Of course it is, yes.
But I speak as a musicologist who's had to explain to his students for over 30 years that Amadeus is just a movie.
Yeah, boy, that's a great point there.
But I took exception to that because I actually saw the original run of 1776 in London when I was 8. And it made a great impression on me, and I've seen many productions since. But it's a very, very dark play, and to call it a comedy.
Yeah.
And also, but one of the things that's humanizing about it is that it does balance the two masks present in drama, comedy and tragedy. And it's a very serious piece of work. I'm not sure Hamilton has quite that depth of intent, at least within its field. It's a different animal altogether. But I'm sorry that, you know, your panel remembers only the funny bits.
No. I take the point, Philip. I do, and I'm glad you called, and I'm really glad you brought up Amadeus, because you talk to anybody in the field of, go down to Classical 91.5 here at WXXI. They can't tell you how many people for years thought Salieri killed Mozart, which did not happen. By all the evidence. But boy, Hollywood made that. So even a movie like Amadeus, which might have won an Oscar, if I'm remembering correctly.
Best actor, yeah.
Yeah, had people thinking that the historical parts of it were true. So that's why I think this matters. That's why, anything you guys want to add to his concern about 1776, but also whether we teach history well or not. I mean, I know that's been something of a passion for you for many years.
I actually have never seen 1776, which I'm realizing I might have to do something about. But yeah, we teach history terribly. That's true. I think, and you know, there's some fantastic teachers doing great work. The learning outcomes in New York State, particularly for the Revolution, reduce it to a constitutional struggle with Great Britain over taxation, and that's really about all students learn about the revolution. It's not, you don't get to the big questions, and I think that's deeply unfortunate. And New York's better than a lot of states in how it teaches the revolution.
Okay, Miriam?
Well, since I'm the person who's at fault for saying that 1770, I'm actually going to, I'll stick to my guns there and say, well, no, unfortunately, it really is still funny in the second act. But Philip is right to point out that it is very much engaged with the civil rights movement, and arguably I think that it deals much better with slavery and the founders than Hamilton does. Certainly Rutledge's Molasses to Rum, which indicts the entire country, right, is far more brutal in terms of how it treats the way in which the founders are implicated, all of them are implicated in slavery, as opposed to the way that Hamilton does it, is true. But I take Philip's point that, yes, just saying that the play is funny, even though it is still funny and that it is making a mockery of a number of characters.
Yeah, sure. And Linda Sue, does it make a difference? One of our listeners wants to know that whether it's 1776 or Hamilton, does it make a difference that it's a musical? We may expect more accuracy in a play. A musical, by its nature, according to this listener, stretches the imagination. No one believes the founders sang out their thoughts. Does that change it at all for you?
I think because of the hold in popular imagination, and we're talking post-social media, right? 1776 was and Hamilton is, which has made a tremendous difference, which is a whole nother show for you, Evan. But I think that as a culture, we value individualism and innovation more than we value history and community. And that is where, whether it's a musical or a Hollywood film or a blockbuster novel, that is the narrative that we are actually trained from very, very young to prefer. And so it will take, a lot of work and a lot of cultural upheaval to shift that value system. But I think that, Michael mentioned wanting, the novel for the American Revolution. And, I agree, except that I want the 20 novels from all different, all different viewpoints and communities.
Right. So a little more feedback. Sarah writes to us to say, I don't adore Hamilton for its historical accuracy. I adore Hamilton because it has helped validate me, the daughter of an immigrant and a person of color, as an American. That's from Sarah. It's a powerful sentiment. I appreciate that, Sarah. And another listener asking, what about Adams on HBO, the miniseries with Paul Giamatti? I know it inspired my sister-in-law and her book group to read all of the bios of the founding fathers. Are those the bios you want them reading?
There's some things that series did well. We could do a whole David McCulloch, since he's got a new book coming out now that we're all lining up to.
Are you a fan?
No, not the new book. The series did a lot of things really well. I mean, I think Adams in some ways is far more interesting. But yeah,
but you're not a McCullough fan.
No. I mean, he writes well and he tells stories, but it's the same stories, the same founding fathers, the same white dominant figures in the history, and there's so many other interesting and important things going on. And like the last person who just messaged in about the validation, we tell stories about. Still telling stories largely about white literate males in history. Get to a point Linda Sue raised earlier, right? White literate males. We're not talking the stories of illiterate whites. We're not telling the story of Native peoples, of African Americans, of women. There's so much going on. Those are the stories we need to tell if we want to create a history that reaches our students.
That's a wonderful sort of a closing argument. And so some final thoughts from you, Linda Sue Park, an award-winning author on we talked about some of the risk of kind of getting history wrong. What's the opportunity in front of the creators when you are creating a work of fiction but based on history? What's the opportunity, you think?
Oh, I think historical fiction is a wonderful way to explore what it actually means to be human. You know, what do we have in common with people 100 or 1,000 years ago? If we can figure that out, then maybe we have, we can work more towards a definition of what all human beings have in common. So that's why it's my favorite genre.
And Miriam, some final thoughts from you about, being maybe good consumers of history. When we're consuming works of fiction, what should we keep in mind? What should we be looking for?
We should always be remembering that the author is, in the end, going to be constrained by the genre that they've chosen. And that will mean that the kind of narratives that they're going to tell, whatever narratives those are, fiction demands verisimilitude, right? It's what we find plausible. And sometimes that the narrative that they're telling that's plausible isn't going to be the historical reality, right? Fiction and history do collide so frequently, right, in that respect. And so even when you're enjoying it, still at the end, ask, well, wait a second, right? What did that author have to choose to do in order to make your encounter with the past so enjoyable, but also perhaps so provoking, right, and so new?
Professor Burstein, who is a professor and associate chair of the Department of English at the College of Brockport. Thanks for being here. Really enjoyed the conversation this hour.
Thank you.
Linda Sue Park, lspark.com, if you want to find more of her outstanding work. It's been great having you. Let's do this again.
Yeah, I'd love to.
And Michael Oberg said that his kids were a fan of Linda Sue Park. I saw that exchange on Twitter. So always good, Professor. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you, Evan.
Very interesting conversation. Listeners, if you didn't get through this hour on the phone, emails, boy, people are fired up about history and fiction. We'll continue to have these conversations here. Our thanks to Gary Puttup behind the glass and Megan Mack, who is the engineer and producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.
Standing there side by side, she takes his hand. It's quiet uptown. Forgiveness. Can you imagine forgiveness? Can you imagine?